Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Frontier Beyond Fear Blog Talk Radio program. I am your host, Susan, Laris, and Danz, and today we have quite a special show lined up, especially for people who are in the Pacific Northwest, as I think many of you may know the guest he's going to be on today. His name is Paul O'Brien, and Paul is what I would characterize as a visionary entrepreneur, someone whose journey was really quite courageous. And given that this is a show about fear, I'm sure we will talk about that to some degree, as Paul actually left an executive position in the 1980s, and he created a new category of software, working with a developer at the time. And that software was essentially the first divination program. And it was called Synchronicity. And I find a tremendous commonality with this path in a sense that I came from the computer science domain as well. And so I find it fascinating how Paul had the courage to follow his guidance, to follow his heart, and create this program, which then was developed into Tarot.com, iching.com, and then after that was sold at some time later, in 2007, Paul eventually went on to create divination.com, associated with the nonprofit Divination Foundation that he created. Today we're going to talk about Paul's newest book, which is the Visionary I Ching, a book of changes for intuitive decision making. And Paul has very generously offered a link to listeners, which you can access on the show page, whether you're listening live or to the podcast. And that link will allow you to download this book for free. So I highly encourage you to do that. I have been spending time with this book, and it is really, truly remarkable, especially as those of us, as we become more aware and more awakened, we really do become aware of this synchronistic flow and how divination can assist us. Paul's first book was Divination, Sacred Tools for Reading the Mind of God. And he's also working on yet another book, which is called Great Decisions, Perfect Timing, The Art of Visionary Decision Making. Now, those of you in Portland have probably heard Paul on the Pathways radio program, which is on KABU, the community network that's local here. And he has done that for 28 years. So it really is quite an honor to have such an experienced interviewer and spiritual host on the show today. We do have an open chat room today if you're listening live, and I welcome you to come in there if you're able. And then also there is a call-in number of 310-807-5104. So without further delay, I am really very delighted to welcome Paul O'Brien on the show. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Susan. Thank you very much for a kind introduction.
Well, thank you. I have to say I am fascinated by your journey. And, what strikes me, and again, this is a show about fear, is there really is courage and such a depth of following one's heart in your journey. And, you know, perhaps you can start the show, because I know so many of us want to follow our hearts in our work. We may be in a career that's totally divergent or seems that way from what we truly want to do. Perhaps you could start with telling us about yours. How did you come to do this, Paul?
Well, you know, it's a relevant question to everybody. And what I like to point out is everybody has a day job and everybody has their creative work.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they aren't doing much creative work yet, but everybody has something to contribute and to be creative about. So, but everybody always has a day job, and we tend to fantasize that, oh, if I was only doing Right Livelihood, then I wouldn't need a day job anymore.
Yeah.
I could just be paid to do what I love. But even when you're doing what you love, like my current situation where I run a nonprofit, and I live off of my investment income because I was able to sell the company for a lot of money, the internet company that you mentioned. And so my day job is I'm an investor. But it used to be my day job was being the CEO and publisher of the world's largest divination and astrology website, tarot.com, with 25 employees and, you know, just 80-hour weeks. And I hardly had much time for my creative work, even though I did design some products and I thoroughly enjoyed that. So my day job then was about 95% of my working energy, and my creative work was about 5%. Now my day job is about 20% of my working energy, and my creative work is about 80%. So that's a wonderful karmic blessing that I've achieved. But I bring this up because, you know, people, we need to accept the fact that we have a day job. It's not, you know, you always have a day job. So for me, I had this day job as an executive in the software industry, and then I had the day job as an entrepreneur. But when I was an executive in the software industry, I had this vision of how software, computer technology, could support spiritual development and could support visionary decision-making, is what I call it. The strategic decisions, the major personal decisions that we have to make in a lifetime, like should I marry this guy or should I change careers or which college should I go to? You know, there's about a dozen major decisions in a life where people shift gears or change directions or something profound happens. And I saw that the technology could support the spirituality because I knew about the I Ching since I was a teenager.
Yes.
And of course I grew up in a Christian family, and but I was introduced to the I Ching in the 60s and in 69, and I was immediately struck by how it reflected my energy back to me. And I'll never forget the first time I tried it. This cute girl was showing it to me, and I was really more interested in her than I was in this oracle system that she wanted to show me. But I went along with it. I played along with it. But I was kind of a 19-year-old smart aleck. And basically, I posed a question that didn't mean anything to me, just to kind of make fun of the whole thing. And I cast the coin 6 times. And then she looked it up in the big book and I got the hexagram number 4, reading number 4, which was entitled Youthful Folly. And the basic message was the student lacks respect for the teacher. And it was like such a perfect reflection of my energy. It completely ignored the question, but it reflected my energy really, really exquisitely. And so I said, I want to try this again. And this time, my intention was to test it. I was more curious about it now, and I wanted to test it, and it came back with a response that went something like questioning the sincerity of the seeker. It was testing me. And oh my God, this thing is—it's not going to put up with any guff from me. And ever since I was 19, I've used the I Ching to inform every major personal decision I've ever made, including the major business strategic decisions. And it's helped me avoid so many mistakes, Susan, I can't even tell you.
You know, do you think that it's typical that so many of us are literally astonished? I mean, I can say this was my path. When this kind of thing started to work, any kind of synchronicity or any kind of divination, there is an astonishment. And also this feeling of wanting to prove it, like you say, test it. You know, you want to prove it to people. And it seems to clash with that logical side of us. And I know that in your book you talk about this, how we're trained in believing in causality, especially if we come through any kind of scientific discipline. And yet what's occurring through the I Ching is much different than that. Can you speak to that? Because I think sometimes when you're on what feels like a traditional path, although I'm not sure how to say what that is, you can feel sort of this clash of systems, and then your logical side really wants to prove it, and yet you're just astonished, sometimes stunned by it.
Yeah. Well, you know, we believe all kinds of things that aren't logical, but we do have a reverence for logic, especially in the West, and science is based on logic. The scientific method is a very logical way to prove things, and so we put a lot of faith in causality, which is basically another way of saying logical linear connections between things. A causes B and B causes C, that kind of thing. And every effect has a cause. This is one of the primary tenets of Newtonian physics. For every action, there is an equal and opposite counter reaction, which is to say causality. So things are caused by something. But in the realm of subatomic physics, which was discovered in the early 20th century, including by Einstein and Bohr and others, they noticed something that they had never been able to notice before because they didn't have the technology, and that was acausal behavior happening in the subatomic realm. So in other words, particles would flip into waves, and waves would flip into particles, and sometimes you'd have two of the same thing in two different places at the same time. Things that defy logic, certainly, and that are not explainable in Newtonian terms.
Yeah.
And this completely messed with their minds. The scientists to this day have a hard time with this. Einstein had a hard time with it, even though he knew it was true. And he didn't dispute the truth of it. He would say things like, God doesn't play dice, because he was just so threatened by acausality, which was the bedrock of science up until that time. And we're still adjusting to the reality that nothing is objective, that just the act of measuring things changes the things themselves. And you can see this at the subatomic realm, and there was another principle called the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which basically was proved, mathematically proven, that you basically can't measure anything objectively because the act of measurement has an effect on the thing being measured. So scientific objectivity flew out the window. Causality had been abrogated, and there's this acausal aspect to life.
Yeah.
Well, Carl Jung, who was friends with all these guys, and he was the great psychologist in the early 20th century, it occurred to him, and the story is that he was having dinner with Einstein. He would have Einstein over for dinner once in a while. Einstein was a friend of his, and Einstein was speculating that maybe there is a relativity in the dimension of time. Now, because Einstein had come up with the theory of relativity, which is basically about space and movement, but he was saying maybe there's a relativity principle that applies to time. And that basically stimulated Jung's intuition, because he was noticing things in the dreams of his clients and all kinds of like incredible coincidences that didn't seem at all to be meaningless. In fact, they seemed to be very meaningful, and he's noticing all these things. And so he basically then was introduced to the I Ching by Wilhelm, who translated it from the Chinese. And so Jung studied the I Ching for like 30 years, and he saw how the I Ching was an embodiment of this a-causal principle that he chose to call synchronicity, which basically means that things, one way of putting it is that things are related in time, that things that happen at the same time are related to each other even if there is no causality, and that you can derive meaning from that. And so it takes in the whole category of amazing coincidences, of dreams, of all kinds of things that can't be explained logically, but really are connected in some manner beyond logic.
Yes.
And so synchronicity was the a causal principle of psychology, and this, in subatomic physics, they had the phenomena that I described. And it was kind of parallel, which I think is very cool. But in any case, what is synchronicity? Synchronicity means that everything, that there are no accidents. That's basically what it means. Now, you can call that God's plan or whatever. It doesn't matter what you call it. What the basic meaning is that everything is unfolding perfectly according to some internal design or grand plan that's beyond our capacity to know. So it's not our job to know why. It's our job to accept and go with the flow and make the best moves we can. It's kind of like improvisational dancing.
Yes.
In order to do that, you have to have some feel. It's very intuitive. It's really an intuitive art. And this is what I'm dedicated to exploring and sharing and teaching, is about the intuitive arts, and specifically intuitive decision making. And I see divination as just one tool for stimulating the intuition around problems that logic all by itself can't handle. And those are many of the big decisions we have to make, have to do with relationships or negotiations or timing of some sort or another. And logic can't handle that. So we have to turn to our intuition, and things like the I Ching or tarot cards can help. And they're not for fortune telling. They are specifically for stimulating your intuition. That's why I wrote that whole book about divination. In fact, the divination is in the Bible all over the place. And you'd think, yeah, sure, God is condemning the astrologers and the divinators. But no, it's not as simple as that. There's more verses in the Bible where God is saying something favorable, or actually telling them to use their divination system to choose the next king, things like that. There's more passages in the Bible where God is reflecting favorably on these mantic arts than there are where he's coming down.
And you know, I find, and it is true, there can seem to be this condemnation, and yet something I was reflecting upon before the show was that I actually learned divination within the context of evangelical Christianity, because I used to open the Bible to a random page, and I know a lot of Christians who would do that.
Yeah, that's called stichomancy. The opening of the book.
I didn't know that. That's interesting. Yeah. I didn't know there was a term.
Mm-hmm. Sticho, Mancy.
Uh-huh.
If you believe there are no accidents, the page you need to see is going to pop up.
It seems that as you become more aware, that can be a remarkable thing. I know that during a time of great awakening for me, actually it was a difficult time, somebody handed me a book about getting through difficult times or something like that. I can't remember what it was called. I opened that book to a passage that started with Susan.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Actually, it might have been this angel book. I can't remember what it was exactly anymore. All I know is it was exactly what I needed to hear, and it had my name in it. I mean, it turned out the author's name was Susan, but it didn't matter. It didn't matter because I didn't select that. I didn't select a book by Susan to see that. And it was just so perfect for me to hear it and so reassuring. And maybe that's another aspect of this. In terms of being reassured.
Absolutely. When you become more highly aware of synchronicity, you become more aware of the fact that it's happening all the time. In fact, it's happening constantly. In other words, everything is unfolding perfectly in synchronicity with everything else. And then you realize, oh, my God, you know, I just take this for granted. And when you start noticing it, you realize, oh, these are just all little miracles.
Uh-huh.
Everything is interconnected. We're all interconnected. And so then you become miracle-minded. And I call that the synchronistic lifestyle. That's when you become very creative because you realize, oh, geez, I'm in the flow. And you start to be more present. You start to be more mindful because you start to notice what's happening right now because what's happening right now has got messages. It's, you know, they used to call it in the Bible, they call it signs and omens. And they're all over the place. And if you have eyes to see them, and that's the intuition. So when you're living the synchronistic lifestyle, your timing gets really good. And it really boils down to decision-making, Susan. If your decision-making improves, even just a little bit, everything is going, it's like compound interest. Everything is going to unfold that much more smoothly for you. You're going to have less resistance because you're making better decisions. And your timing is automatically going to get better. And you know why? Because timing is a decision. Timing is an intuitive decision. It answers the question. There's two. When you have a major decision, there's two components. There's two sides to it. There's the what, and there's the when. And the what is what is the next best move that I can make?
Yeah.
And the when, out of all the choices I have. And the when has to do with, and when should I pull the trigger? When should I make that move? And that's the timing question. So if you're good at intuitive decision making, your timing is going to improve. And, you know, just things start to get a lot more fun and a lot easier.
Yeah, I have to say that just based on the kind of synchronicities I've seen, for example, turning on the radio at just the right time and the song that's playing is directly relevant to whatever I might have asked or whatever I was thinking, it's as if reality becomes richer and you never want to go back. I mean, I think about when I was younger and it didn't seem to happen as much. I just didn't observe it as much. That reality was much flatter to me. I mean, now it just gets richer and richer and more exciting. I mean, I think it's an amazing, really phenomenal. And shared synchronicities are fun, where you're with a group of people and you all see it. You're all into that. Have you had that happen where a group of people observe something? And there's just something really affirming about that, too, because at first you think, you know, am I just going crazy? But you can't be because it's there. I mean, you can go back. I've heard songs on the radio that were so perfect, I can go back to the playlist and say, yes, that was playing. I mean, you know, my concrete self that wants to prove it can prove it. And group synchronicities are fun when something just happens together.
Yeah, I mean, and I think, you know, it's very possible that women have a greater facility for that. Group synchronicity.
Now, go ahead.
No, no, you.
Well, I was going to say, there's another aspect of this, and this is something I really want to ask you about. When this started to happen to me many years ago, there was a trust element, because when you're raised as a Christian, you're told there can be different sources. You know, where is this coming from? And I have to say, I spiraled into fear. And part of my journey for a while. And so how about fear and lack of trust in it and you know, actually being frightened of where is this coming from? How do you address that, Paul?
Well, you know, the problem with a closed system is a closed system of philosophy or religion where it says if you entertain any doubts about any of this, that's the devil tempting you.
Yeah.
And your soul is in mortal danger. That's a great way to just shut down learning. And that's kind of, I think that's a learning, that's where fear becomes a learning disorder. And we don't need to do that. My advice along these lines is that the most important thing is to learn to trust yourself and to trust your own intuition. I don't think it matters what a person believes. And, of course, this has been a big debate in the Christian church for 1,000 years.
Yeah.
Can you be saved by faith or by good works? And it's been an ongoing debate, and the faith camp basically won out. And to the extent that it's believed that if you declare your faith in Jesus as your personal Savior, etc., that you're going to be saved no matter what. Whereas in a religion like Buddhism, for instance, it doesn't matter what you believe. It's all contingent upon whether you do the spiritual practices that are going to make you more awake and enlightened, and it doesn't matter one iota what you believe. And so I was heavily influenced by that because I studied all the religions. When I got to be an adult, I decided, hey, I'm going to look around. I want to see what's out there, and I don't want to operate out of fear. But, you know, so any fear-based system is probably, any fear-based system is not a good idea. It's not good for learning.
Yeah, it's very funny. Go ahead.
I was going to say, it's very funny how we honor people sometimes by saying that they have strong convictions. You know, like George Bush was a man of principle because he had strong convictions, which means he knows what he knows and he's never going to change his mind. And, you know, I think that strong convictions are a learning disorder. I think that we should always actively question our beliefs. Our beliefs should be subject to scrutiny for the rest of our lives because they're operating assumptions and they can evolve and we can learn and we can adapt. We don't have to, like, adopt some dogma from, you know, the Iron Age and expect it to encompass our reality or even come close to answering all the questions that we have, which is kind of why I rewrote the vision, why I created my own version of the I Ching, because it too is ancient. I mean, it's older than the Bible. Mm-hmm. It's about it's a little older than the Old Testament. It's about 3,500 years old. But, you know, it's coming out of a, it was reworked and reworked over the centuries, and it basically, to the point where when it was brought to Carl Jung in the early 20th century, it was very patriarchal and very militaristic and really reflected the realities, the social realities of, you know, 2,000 years ago.
Yeah.
And yet it had this timeless wisdom based on yin and yang and love versus fear, etc., that was really helpful if you read between the lines, but it was really kind of a lot of work to read between the lines sometimes because it would say things like, the army is marching to the southwest. Well, that might have meant something in China, in the Middle Kingdom, in 2,000 years ago, but it doesn't mean anything to me. So that's why I wanted to create a version that was suitable for modern times.
Can you speak to Taoism a little bit, Paul, and how it relates to that philosophy? I know you talk about the yin and the yang, and how is Taoism reflected through the I Ching? And, you know, maybe educate us all a little bit in that.
Well, the I Ching actually is one of the five classics of Taoism.
Yes.
So it's considered to be a fruit of Taoism. And it's based on the idea that you can boil things down into yin and yang, the two primordial elements or the primordial duality, and then they have eight elements and et cetera. So all of these systems, like astrology, okay, you've got the 10 planetary orbs, you've got the 12 signs, you've got the 12 houses. You know, all of these systems are just ways of trying to understand reality. And some of them are very elegant. And so the I Ching, they divide up reality into 64 different archetypes. And that's another concept that Carl Jung explored for us, the concept of archetypes. So a divination system basically consists of archetypes operated upon by the synchronicity principle. And if I might go back to what we were talking about earlier before, that's what divination is. It's the ability to create a synchronicity with the goal of stimulating the intuition around some decision that needs to be made or some dilemma that you have to deal with. So it's sort of like intentional synchronicity creation. And then it helps you interpret the pattern that you create. So the synchronicity is, this pattern that I create by tossing the coin six times is related to everything else that's happening right now, and we're going to interpret it according to what's on your mind right now, whatever you've been meditating on while you were holding the coins. That's the synchronicity. So it's just like an intentional synchronicity in order to get advice related to this moment in time around what I'm focused on.
Yes.
And so Taoism... basically, Taoism is not a religion, in my view. Taoism is a philosophy, and it's a philosophy of living where that strives to maintain a harmonious balance between the yin and the yang. And I'm sure you're familiar with that symbol of the Tao.
Yes.
Where you have the two inverted paisleys with the dot in the middle. And the white one's got a black dot in the middle. And the left one has got a white, the white one has a black dot in the middle, which means that nothing is ever completely yin or completely yang. And then it's got that inverted paisley shape to connotate the whole notion of flowing from one state to another and back again. And so everything is just sort of like morphing. It's kind of like a psychedelic light show.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why psychedelic light shows were so popular. Because they basically resonated with this way of looking at things that was ancient. But in any case, Taoism is about flow. It's about being in the flow, or what athletes call being in the zone. It's about being balanced between the yin and the yang, and which are always flowing back and forth, but ultimately coming to balance. And you know, that's the masculine and the feminine. One beautiful thing about Taoism was how egalitarian it was. It was not patriarchal, at least not philosophical. Then Confucius came along, and he put a big patriarchal stamp on the I Ching, which he spent decades himself. Confucius spent decades working on this thing, and so did Carl Jung. You know, I mean, this, and so have I. Not that I am comparable to those guys, but in my small way, I've spent a lot of time on it, and it's an inspiring inspiring reality, and anybody can do it for themselves. You don't need a tarot card reader. So I love it. You know, it's been one of the two fascinations of my life, with the other one being software.
Yeah,
and I write about in my new book about Great Decisions, Perfect Timing. I talk about how the fascinations, whatever you were fascinated with during stage one of your life, stage one being the first 30 years, which is about self-discovery, the things that you became fascinated by, these are like guiding stars to your destiny. These things are probably related to what you're meant to do or what you would love to do. Or of your creative potentials. And in my case, it certainly was true, because these two things fascinated me in my youth, and I got involved with both of them. I got into the software business, and I used the I Ching my adult life. And then 15 years later, the idea occurred to me, wouldn't it be convenient and very cool if I could cast the I Ching using my computer? The computer could take care of all of the busy work, like recording the lines and looking up the reading that you got. And maybe there's a way I could use the mouse and the keyboard to cast the coins in a way that was energetically authentic, as well as mathematically authentic. And maybe there's a way that this technology can introduce this wonderful ancient technology of the I Ching to a modern audience. Maybe there's an intersection between these two things. And sure enough, there was. It made sense. And I discovered the intersection between software and divination and created the world's first divination program, which was an I Ching program, which, guess what I called it, Susan? Guess what name I gave it?
I know the answer, but I'll let you tell us.
Of course. And
yes.
And even though that product never made a lot of money or anything, the I Ching was the least remunerative thing I ever did. It was the soul of the company, and I started my own business, and I starved for the next 15 years. And then the Internet came along, and we got a deal to provide all the horoscopes for AOL and for Google and for MySpace, and all of a sudden, kaboom, the doors blew off the place. We had so much traffic. So
yeah.
this little Oregon company that I started in my basement 15 years earlier all of a sudden started becoming hugely profitable with 6 million members and, you know, 2 million page views a day. I mean, it was just ridiculous.
That's really amazing. You know, that's what so many of us dream of, although in a way don't necessarily expect, but to have something like that actually happen, I mean, that's truly miraculous that you were so in the flow and how the pieces of your path. It seems like when I hear the stories of the various enlightened individuals who have come onto the show, it's amazing how the little threads of your paths early on, they end up weaving together and coming to this amazing place much later that you never could have foreseen. You know, sometimes we ask, why did I do that? You know, why did I make that choice in my youth? You know, sometimes I question, why did I go into computer science? You know, the fascinating thing about computer science, it actually is very intuitive, or it was for me. There were many times if I were asked to solve some really challenging bug and I had, you know, one product I had, it had like a million lines of code, and it was just handed to me, and I didn't consider myself the most brilliant computer scientist. I wasn't. I really wasn't. And yet somehow you would get this leap of intuition and find it. And I actually had the chance to talk to and someone who was in a leadership role at my company close to the time that I left, and I was in a software company in the Pacific Northwest, and I was really surprised when he told me, he was a math major in college, that he would have to go out in nature and the answer to a proof would come to him, because to me that was daunting too. I was a math major too early on, and I sometimes wondered, you know, do we really even know how we do these things? I mean, did other people do this more methodically than I did? And this, you know, maybe intuition was playing a role more than we realized, and we weren't admitting to it.
Yeah, oh, definitely. I mean, intuition has been involved in many of the greatest scientific discoveries
mm-hmm.
that came through dreams or, that's a well-known fact. Even though the scientific community doesn't give intuition the credit it deserves. But anyway, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, what does it
it's
mean
beautiful
to make a discovery?
Beautiful thing, but, you know, you really have to learn how to trust yourself.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so important to get past fear. You know, I'll tell you my analogy of the intuition that might help people understand it. Let's say that if you look at your hand, like if you just look at your hand right now and you stretch your fingers out, and if you think of your hand in the palm of your hand as being your mind, and then you've got these five, hopefully, five fingers that are antennas. You think of them as antennas, and they represent the five senses. And they're vision, sound, hearing, touch, et cetera. And they're huge. And then if you could think of it as if you had this sixth, because these signals are very strong. You know, half the brain, half the cortex is devoted to just to sight alone. I mean, that's just huge. And that's why That's why people are so easily distracted visually. It's such a strong sense. But we have these five senses, and then we're perceiving things that come to our mind. And then there's this tiny little sixth one. Imagine that there's a little finger that's much smaller than the little finger, and it's right next to it. This tiny little fine little needle of an antenna, that's the intuition. And it's been called the sixth sense forever, I mean for a thousand years. But it's calibrated to a much quieter signal, and whereas these other ones are very, very noisy signals, sounds, sights, etc. So that's the first problem, is the intuition can't receive things because there's too much noise going on in the environment. And then you have the noise that happens inside of the mind itself, which is the chattering of the monkey mind. It never stops chattering.
Yeah.
So intuition's got a hard time competing with all this noise in the system. And then there's another thing, you have these we have these containment domes of over on top of this little antenna to make things worse that are blocking the signal, and these containment domes of fear or other emotional biases that prevent us from being open. If you're not open, you can't be receptive. We're talking about receptivity here. Intuition is not something that you can force. It's a reception. You know, it's like your eyeballs are receivers. Your intuition is a receiver, and if you're not open, if it's blocked off, and if there's too much noise going on all the time, it doesn't work. It doesn't work in any effective way, and that's why being out in nature is so helpful, because it's a way to quiet down. It's a more harmonious environment in a quieter place where this still small voice of the intuition or this subtle signal can be perceived.
You know, I have even heard, and actually to some degree have experienced this, although I tune it out, and I'm really curious what you would say to this, is fear-based coincidences, as if you're projecting your fear. It's almost as if, and I've actually talked to someone who was a very conservative Christian. I was like in a discussion forum with this person, and he was describing this phenomenon where he was projecting a lot of fear, and he would see confirmations of his fear, like, you know, demonic things. It doesn't come through as strong, I don't feel. I mean, I think that it's sort of, I don't know what to call it. And it really got me to wondering about this, if it's a projection to a point, but it's not very powerful when it happens. It doesn't have the power of the love-based synchronicity. Yeah, what do you say to that? I have been so curious about that, because it troubles me. I will tell you, it's one of those things that troubles me a little bit, that such a thing could even happen, that, you know, this man talked about this.
So, you know,
he was walking. What do you say?
I would not classify this as a synchronicity, because
so
I think
what
it's...
So what is it? Like, if he claims he heard a radio song that he randomly turned on that confirmed some fear, was it just surfacing that fear to be examined?
They
can read it as saying, oh, you have to be afraid of that thing because, you know, the song or the billboard. I think that was part of it, too. You know, he saw a very fearful billboard, and it's like... It was surfacing the fear more than confirming it. Is that possible?
Yeah, I mean, it's like if you buy a new car, let's say you buy a car that there's not a lot of that type of car on the road, you're going to start seeing that car all over the place.
That's true. Even
before you take delivery of it, and it's the law of attraction, basically. Whatever you think about, whatever you focus on in your mind, whatever you're preoccupied with, that's what you're going to project, and that's what you're going to notice, and you're going to start noticing it more often than you used to, even if it's not actually happening any more often at all.
Yeah, so it's not necessarily confirming anything. It's not guiding you down
some
fear-based path.
It's just confirming one thing, the fact that you're obsessed.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're reflecting. It's like it's reflecting right back to you. What you're thinking.
Yeah, I mean, people only hear what they want to hear because they want to have what they currently believe to be confirmed. And why do they want that? Because they think it's important what they believe, and they're dedicated to being right. into being righteous in their belief system. Somebody like me comes along and says, I don't care what you believe. It doesn't matter. I don't think you should care either. Let go of it. Test your beliefs. Put them to the test. Play with them.
Right.
It doesn't matter what you believe. You know, this is such a radical proposition for most people who, you know, basically have been, you know, conditioned to believe that what they believe is important.
Right.
I don't think what I believe is important. Of course, it is important in a sense that it's an operating assumption, and we need to believe that when we want to walk, our legs are going to work, or that, you know, Paris is in France, or whatever that makes sense to us, and we use these kind of beliefs as functional operating assumptions that help us get from A to B or to do something. So beliefs are important, but their importance is very relative. They're not going to save your soul. They're not that important. And they should be subject to change. You know, I think it's much more important how you live, whether you love people, whether you are generous, whether you are kind.
Yes.
And the, you know, and this is the stuff that Jesus emphasized too. I'm no longer a Christian, but I totally respect what Jesus taught, and he was all about love and loving yourself too. How can you love yourself if you're constantly in a state of fear? It's impossible.
You know, we missed that. You know, how do you love your neighbor as yourself if you don't love yourself? If you think that,
right,
you know, you're the lowest of the low. There's a certain inconsistency there, and it's true. It's so important.
Right. So, you know, but it's all good. We're all, hopefully, we're going to, we're changing, the culture is changing fast. And people are becoming, I think there's a movement towards becoming more open-minded, and then there's also a movement on the other side to becoming more rigid. The problem is that becoming more rigid is not a sustainable strategy, because at some point you get so brittle that you break. Whereas becoming more open is a sustainable strategy, because you become more flexible and more adaptable, like a willow tree in a hurricane.
Yeah.
So, you know, the from an evolutionary point of view, it comes down on the side of being open. Survival or happiness comes down on the side of being open.
Well,
we
absolutely. And, you know, many of us have seen that reflected in our lives. I mean, when I was pursuing a more rigid point of view, or fell sway to that, my life was much more miserable. I mean, it's when you open up. And I think a lot of people, even if they're in a rigid place, deep down, they have these doubts and insecurities. But they've been told, you must believe this or else. You know, it's that fear element trying to keep them in line. But it's really not working, because deep in their soul, deep in their inner selves, they're having these doubts. You know, would God do these really horrible
things like that? Well, the doubts keep coming, of course. Thoughts arise. You can't stop thoughts from arising. But they consider the doubts to be threats, and so they are basically doubling down all the time and fortifying their defenses even more. And it just, in the long run, it's exhausting, and it'll make a person miserable.
It does. Although I have to say, it was my own doubt that delivered me. It was not an easy journey. And I'm thankful for every part of it. And I've known other people who have gone through this. And ultimately, I was led into a much more open-minded path. I mean, that's where I am now. I don't call myself a part of any religious system anymore. I'm more spiritual than anything else. And I know other people, the same thing has happened to them. And it's just, and then somehow that more rigid part of you, that more fear-based part of you, it played a role. It played a role in who you are now. Even a contrast, you know, just how what it feels like to open up, you know, to true unconditional love and trust. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of trust in these systems. I mean, you know, in a positive way, not trusting something deceptive, but just actually trusting in something higher that cares about your higher good, you know. And to me, what would you say to that, Paul, in terms of divination? Do you have this tremendous sense of, hey, this is, you know, an extension of myself and more than myself, and it's helping me? I mean, that's the whole point. It's the most supportive thing in the world.
Yeah. It's basically evidence of a friendly universe.
Yes.
I agree with you about that for sure. You know, people have asked me. Of course, I was a businessman, and then I who happened to use the I Ching once in a while, which nobody knew. And I, after I started, you know, this kind of quirky software business and struggled with it for so long, people were wondering what was wrong with me.
Yes.
I mean, I had no support at all. It just seemed like a crazy thing to do from a business point of view. Plus, they weren't sure it wasn't crazy from other points of view.
Yep.
And people very often would ask me, like businessmen would ask me, do you really believe in this stuff? And I would just say, I would say, it doesn't really require belief. Of course, even back then, I had the same, I had already developed my philosophy about beliefs and what they're good for and what they're not. And I said, it doesn't really require belief. It's not a religion. I said, either it stimulates your intuition because you're ready to let that happen and it works for you, or it doesn't. I don't care. It's a tool that's helped me,
mm-hmm.
And I'm not asking you to believe in anything. I'm not even asking you to try it, but I'm suggesting that you might want to try it and see what happens for you. Does it help you think outside the box? Does it give you just one new idea? Does it give you some kind of mental clarity just because you're approaching something from a more objective point of view enough to name it and to actually cast a reading about it? That gives you a little bit of non-attachment right there. The minute you give something a name, say, this is the subject, this is what's on my mind, and I want to get a reflection on that, the minute that you put it out there, you've got something distance from it, which is kind of comforting and helps you be more objective rather than just a super amount of attachment for one imagined outcome or another. So
yeah.
I think the I Ching is very good in curing magical thinking in the sense that it gives you a reflection that doesn't give a damn about your ego or what you want to hear.
And yet some people would say it is magical thinking. You know, I've heard that said. You know, if you believe in any kind of tool like that, that's magical thinking. It's not really, you know, that.
Yeah, but they don't know what they're talking about. They don't know what to.
They love to use that term.
They're making a lot of assumptions about it, and one of the assumptions is they think that it requires you to adopt some faith system, and it doesn't. I'm just saying this thing is a tool for stimulating the intuition. Maybe it'll work for you. Maybe it won't. That's it. I don't go any further than that.
You know, that in itself really reflects something important. And I'll tell you, this is something I have struggled with. And I can see that you've managed to get through this. Is when you're pursuing something that to other people doesn't seem to make sense, especially if they're in some traditional discipline, whatever, they're very focused on logic, it really takes strength to withstand their judgment and not internalize it. And it seems like what you've done is you've just said, you know, I'm not trying to convince you of this. I'm just saying this is working. And sometimes they'll even say, you know, it doesn't look like it's working. I mean, I feel this now. You know, I've left the corporate world and I'm pursuing a path. I haven't made millions of dollars, not yet. I mean, I'm in that place, and I know a lot of people are, especially in this economy where you've trusted in something, and you're kind of stubborn and even patient, and I know your book speaks to that. But I think how you withstood the judgment. I mean, did it ever get to you at some point? Did you ever feel uncomfortable with some of the judgment you were receiving, and how did you work through that for yourself?
Well, when I was a kid, 19, same time I got introduced to the I Ching, I was going to school at Cal Berkeley, and basically I was exposed to the counterculture, and I let my hair grow long, and I basically found more warmth in the counterculture than I had found in my own family, which was very dysfunctional and not very warm. And so I learned to, it was kind of a rebellion thing. Now kids, you know, plaster their bodies with tattoos, whatever. And I learned, but having long hair was a highly visible thing at the time, and it was very radical at the time. And I basically wanted to overcome the fear of embarrassment and the fear of what other people thought, because even at that young age, I realized I can't be objective about what other people are thinking anyway. All I'm doing is projecting what I think they're thinking. And this is kind of what everybody's doing. You know, you walk down the street and you wonder what people are thinking of you if they're noticing you. And they're doing exactly the same thing, and everybody's looking at themselves. Nobody's noticing anybody. But
you know, so that's sad, and it's true.
Yeah, and I realized that. And then I said, you know, I'm going to make it a project. I want to get free of caring about what other people think.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to be just, like, totally true to myself. And I made that a project at age 21. And so I've been working on that for a long time.
Yeah, well, and good for you.
Yeah, it just easier over time. Just like I don't care what people believe, I don't really care what they think. There's a great expression that says, I don't care what other people think. They don't do it that much anyway. But I basically, probably less than most people I've ever met, do I care what other people think. On the other hand, I don't really want to antagonize anybody.
No,
I'm not
of course
always
not.
Looking for an argument. And I don't assume that I'm right.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, you're authentically yourself, and you know, I do admire that. It takes a kind of courage, and it's obvious you've been working on it a while. It's certainly been a journey for me, and I know for others that I talk with, it is a journey to be authentic and not project what you think other people are thinking.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard sometimes. You know, I mean, we all have our insecurities.
We all,
especially in this society, you know, it's shame-based and fear-based. It's easy to feel insecure. And then, of course, humans have always felt insecure. There's a lot of things about life that are not guaranteed. So there's a lot of reasons to feel, it's easy to feel insecure, and I think you're right. It does take courage to face up to it, to stand up for yourself. In the face of fear.
Yes.
I love the name of your show, you know, Frontiers.
Well, thank you. And, you know, the irony of my show is I don't claim to have mastered my fear. For me, it's a moment-by-moment thing. And, you know, it's a journey. I know that I am in more mastery of it than I used to be. But, you know, I just feel that we would all live much richer, more fulfilling lives. And that's what I want to pass on to my child as well. You know, that's what I want to pass on.
One of the things about fear, it's a very, it's so primordial, and we tend to have a hair trigger response to fearful stimuli. You know, if you hear a rattlesnake tail go off next to you, you're going to jump. And this was a survival thing that was relevant for, you know, well, they say Homo sapiens in its current form is about 200,000 years old. As a species, but it's much older than that. It depends how you define it. And we had to worry about these survival things for, you know, let's say a million years. Out of a million years, we had to worry about it for 995,000 years.
Yes.
Well, in fact, longer than that. Just 99% of our entire history, we've had to worry about stuff that a lot of us don't have to worry about anymore.
See, that's why I feel we're evolving, you know, out of that survival mode. But, you know, I probably should interject because the live show is about to end, and I want to make sure people know that your website is divination.com. And anything else you want to say, the podcast will continue for, it doesn't cut off abruptly, but anyone listening live.
I would like to say, Susan, that I'm very grateful for lots of things, including the opportunity to be on your show today. And I knew I was going to feel that way, and I set something up to express my gratitude to you and your listeners. And on behalf of your show, we've set up a secret page on divination.com where people can go, like you said earlier, and get a free copy of the Visionary I Ching ebook, which we're going to keep that page up there until February 10th, which is the Chinese New Year's. And so anybody who goes there and signs up to our newsletter, which you can cancel at any time, can download a free copy of the book. And the page is divination.com/frontier. That's it.
And there is a link to it on the show page, which I'll keep up there. I'll keep the link on there until February 10th. Is that what you say?
That's
and
right.
That's really, really generous of you. And you will find, you know, I really recognize, I know you have a podcast too, as well as a broadcast show. I really recognize the energy of that audience that's listening in the future. And that's the vast majority of our audience. But most of them, you know, will listen in the coming week. I know that. And so thank you so much, Paul, for that. And, you know, I am just so happy to become more aware of what you're doing. I've certainly had an awareness of pathways being in Portland, but just knowing this work that you're pursuing and what your full path has been, it's an inspiration to many of us. I mean, you know, I think we can be happy where we're planted in a sense. Not every one of us is going to sell a company, you know, for some huge amount of money and or whatever, but it doesn't matter. It's just that you really reflect what a person can accomplish when they follow their heart and a perseverance.
I wasn't trying to sell the company. I never had.
Yeah, I know you weren't. It just happened. I mean, that's amazing to me. I mean, your story is amazing. It really is. It's magical.
Well, thank you. It's, you know, the whole story of and all of the work that we're doing now, which is totally nonprofit, is at divination.com if anybody else wants to look into it. But I really appreciate your interest, Susan, and am honored that you had me on the show.
Well, I'm very honored you were here. So thank you again, Paul. And I do hope people will take advantage of your free offer, which I know they will, because I've already enjoyed your book, and I want to go even deeper into it and spend even more time with it. It's really opening me up to some things.
Well, you know what? We're coming out with a Visionary I Ching app for iPhones and Android phones. It'll be out in about a week.
Wow.
And so it's I'm really, really excited about it. That'll be advertised on the homepage at divination.com in about a week.
Okay, well, that's great. We will all be on the lookout for that. And I personally will say you have inspired me to learn more about the I Ching. You know, I hadn't explored that. And I now think that maybe, you know, my simple version of synchronicity, you know, whether it be cards or turning on the radio or whatever, can go to a new depth, you know, by using an ancient tool. There's no reason, you know, there's something very powerful in taking advantage of something that's been with us for so long and seeing what it does. I'm really curious. I mean, I have to be honest. So thank you so much, Paul.
It's been a pleasure.
All right. Well, take care, and I look forward to hearing you on your show. So I will definitely be following that in the future. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. Take care.
You too. Just a couple show notes as we wrap up today's broadcast of The Frontier Beyond Fear. First of all, if you want to learn about future shows or go to the archive, the website is frontierbeyondfear.com. And I also have a couple of announcements. The next show will be Saturday, February 9th, and the time is yet to be determined, so keep an eye on the show page, and I'm going to be doing that show live from the Los Angeles Conscious Life Expo from my booth. And it's been a little while since I've done that. I did it in 2011, but it was very fun and very well received at the time, and so I'm planning to do that again, and we'll see what kinds of interesting guests happen to come by. I'm also going to be speaking in Los Angeles Friday, February 8th at 5 p.m., and my topic just happens to be the frontier beyond fear. And so I am going to talk about some of my own journey dealing with my own fears, and actually talk together with the audience, working together interactively through our fears, no matter what path that we've come from and where we're at. We will teach each other. I'm not intending to be a teacher necessarily. I am going to be a teacher and a student during that discussion. And that's Friday, February 8th, 5 p.m. at the Hilton LAX, which is at the Los Angeles Conscious Life Expo. And then one final announcement. Also at that event, filmmaker Phil Lernis and X-Files regular Dean Haglund are going to be at my booth, which is number 706, on Sunday, February 10th. And they will be talking to people and also taping the Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, where I'll be talking with them for a little bit, and then more guests from the expo will be coming on to chat with them. So that's very exciting. So if you happen to be in Los Angeles, or if you are going to Los Angeles to the Conscious Life Expo, please do come by and say hello. My booths are very open and welcoming. I just like to talk with people, and there are always some really fascinating people that come through. And I'm right next to the food this time, so, and the music. So I'm sure people will enjoy coming by this particular location, and I'm looking forward to it too. So thank you again, everyone, for being with us today. I hope that this has really expanded all of us to some new tools and new ways of thinking. I know I am personally very intrigued by this and realizing that I can take my own practice to greater depth and expand to using new tools that perhaps in what was a rather sheltered youth I was not exposed to long ago. And so now I'm just excited in that exercise of discovery that I think that Paul has helped us with today. So thank you again, everyone, and I hope wherever this show finds you, it finds you in a peaceful state of mind. I will see you next time.